2008, Chatham House, London. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Okay, as an introduction, please could you briefly describe your career to date?
Yeah. I am currently the marketing director of Tellus Label Division, but previously, until about 5 years ago, when I was 55, I was in the Royal Navy, where I served the biggest chunk of my professional career. I joined in 1965, spent 37 years in the service. Most of those in the submarine service, and most of those related with the Polaris and Trident programs. In the early part, of course, I was in the operational end of the submarine domain, and served in both conventional and nuclear submarines. But as in all service careers, at around the 40 mark, I changed tack and became a bureaucrat. And again, most of that was focused on the Polaris and Trident programs, firstly in the acquisition cycle, very much down in the Bath, Bristol, procurement executive end, and later in the policy end in modern main building. And my last job related with the program was as director of policy in 1999 to 2002. I remain sort of engaged in the program in that my company obviously has an interest in it, and I front the topic.
Fantastic, thank you very much. Now today we're talking about the MDA, the 1958 Mutual Defence Agreement, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit in a little bit more detail about that and how you think Anglo-American relations have affected you and have changed over time. So if I could start off with kind of a broad question, do you think, or could you tell me a little bit more about what you think were the more significant accomplishments during your
yes.
work?
Yes. I mean, the MDA is one of two what I would call pivotal agreements underpinning our nuclear deterrent capability. One obviously being the NDA, the other being the Polaris Sales Agreement, and the one that's been modified with Trident. Those two taken together, I say, are pivotal to us being able to maintain an affordable deterrent capability in this country. I would go so far as to say that without those two agreements, I think the road to by which that we have maintained an independent nuclear deterrent capability would have been much, much more rocky than it has been. Largely because through those two agreements, we are able to maintain the capability at an affordable price. And I think that has made it more acceptable to the nation and the public at large.
Do you think then that if the MDA and possibly more importantly, the Polaris Sales Agreement hadn't occurred, hadn't been agreed in the same format, that Britain would still be a nuclear power?
I think that's very questionable because, as I say, I think if you compare us with the French, who have been totally independent, I have huge admiration for them having achieved what they have achieved by themselves, but my goodness, look at the cost. Mm. And I think the cost of the programme in the UK, because I think there's politically there is much more support throughout the French political establishment and in the French public, force to fact, than there is within the UK. I think the UK has pretty resolute support in principle for an independent nuclear deterrent, certainly in the main political parties do, and at the public at large. But, and the but is, as long as it's affordable. And I think the fact that we've been able to do it cheaper price than the French have helped enormously, and I think it would have been brought into question much, much more had we had to go it alone. And I think if you're asking me a straight black and white question, it would be very particular whether we'd been able to maintain it ourselves.
Fantastic, thank you very much. I'd like to carry on a little bit more about the kind of the broader nature of the relationship, and if you could summarise a little bit about what you think would be the limitations on the relationship. Are there any reasons why you think America hasn't helped Britain, or has not helped as much as it possibly could have?
Right. Well, I think I'm a realist about the relationship. I've had to deal with it not at the political, diplomatic level, but in what I call the practical level, from both the operational side, the acquisition side, and day-to-day policy issues with the United States. So So I am not a great romantic about our relationship. I believe it to be essentially a political relationship with the United States and a geostrategic one. I think there is a high-level common interest in ensuring the spread of democracy and the defense of freedom throughout the world. I think that is a common held view. But as we go down to levels below that, there are differences in our perspective of the world do appear. So I think the nuclear agreement has benefits to both sides, and they are different types of benefits. I think to us, I've articulated already, we essentially get an independent nuclear capability, and we can go and talk about what we mean by independence, if you like, at a very, very at an affordable price. But I think the United States gets some real political benefits as well. I don't use the term special relationship. I don't use the term bridge to Europe. But I do think there are benefits to the United States in ensuring that they have alongside them a second decision-making center on nuclear matters where they have some influence. I also think within NATO, where the United States finds Europe and NATO very, very difficult to deal with. I think it was Kissinger who once said that he would prefer to deal with the Soviet Union than his European partners. It's kind of easier, anyway. And I think the fact that the United States has an ally in things like the Nuclear Planning Group and the high-level group and the establishments later that deal with nuclear affairs is of major benefit to them. So I think there is a sort of quid pro quo here. There are political and geostrategic benefits to both sides.
Do you think that the agreement and the agreement subsequently in the collaboration between Britain and America has been influenced, and if so, to what extent, by individual personalities?
Oh, certainly. Because I think the nature of our... When I say the relationship is political, the nature of the relationship is very much governed by the two administrations that are in power at any one time, mm-hmm. the UK and the US. And even more so with the United States, the personalities of the President and the Prime Minister are actually critical in how that relation manifests itself within our two sort of bureaucracies. I mean, the two classic ones I think we have to have a look at are, would be the Reagan-Thatcher relationship, which is very close, and the more extraordinary one to my mind, which is the Blair-Bush one of recent times. And, you know, those personal relationships certainly do filter down almost directly to the ebb and flow of information, which is what these two agreements are. One is about procurement of a strategic weapon system. The other is about really the ebb and flow of nuclear information, particularly nuclear information. And, you know, the volume, if you like, of that flow is very much dependent on the nature of the political relationship. So yes,
fantastic. Now, a lot of people have said that events between Britain and America, and the most common example, particularly in recent scholarship, is Nassau, that the relationship's quite ambiguous in the sense that a lot of things are broadly agreed and then in some senses either left up to either group's determination or inference from it. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit whether you think the relationship is ambiguous in some parts, or whether you think that it's...
Well, I think it is. In some parts, yes. As I said at the outset, at the very highest level, there are sort of very... I'm actually not a great believer that a lot of politicians and diplomats talk about shared values between us and the United States. I actually am slightly sceptical about that view. I think if you really say, well, what do you mean by values, the differences between the UK and the US are really quite acute in most of the areas of values that I would look at. However, as I said earlier, I do think there is an overall geostrategic view of the world about the notion of democracy, the freedom, and with current policy, that an interventionist policy to promote democracy and freedom. There is that broad agreement which sort of cements the two countries together at the very highest level.
Yep.
But when you come down a couple of levels to the operational level and to the management of day-to-day management of nuclear deterrent or our nuclear deterrent policy, then differences certainly emerge. And I think actually my own view is that the relationship with the United States is at its very best is when there was just a slight degree of tension between the two countries. By that I mean that there are slightly different views of how things might be going. Not too much, but a little bit of tension there. And out of that comes
that's fascinating. Could you tell me a little bit more about the operational level?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in operations, we are very close to the Americans. Particularly, when I'm talking about operations and policy, of course, we have to understand that the United States operates a triad, nuclear capability, air, land, and sea. We, of course, only have a submarine-based capability now, and have had for about 10 years or so. And it is that area which I'm most familiar with, the maritime capability. So I'm not here talking about air or land, which we don't have. But in the maritime capability, there is a very strong operational relationship anyway in the submarine domain, not only in the nuclear deterrent area, but in the anti-submarine warfare, particularly during the Cold War. There was an awful lot. But having said that, I mean, what is interesting as an observer is the enormous cultural differences between the United States Navy and the Royal Navy. They are two very, very different beasts. The United States Navy is much more political, much more engaged, especially at the senior level, in the political establishment, whereas the Royal Navy is rather more disengaged. The American U.S. Navy takes itself extremely seriously. I mean, one of the quirks I quite like about the Royal Navy is it doesn't take itself too seriously, actually. I think the armed forces in this country have never been a political force. They are not serious operators in the politics of the country. Basically, they are there to go and execute foreign policy tasks as dictated by the government of the law, and that's what they do to the best of their ability. The USM is very different. So, culturally, there are differences, but with common operational objectives and common sort of kit at the most basic level, the submarine level, there is an affinity there, and which worked extremely well during the Cold War in particular.
I'd like to elaborate a little bit more on one of those points, which is fascinating. You were talking about almost a distinct British approach to operations and a distinct British approach to strategy. Do you think that was lessened or increased following Polaris? Because I think most people would assume that it was by taking the technology, or predominantly American technology, and employing it in a British sphere, that it would almost be less British than the period preceding it. Or do you think that's unfair?
If we're talking about the nuclear deterrent capability now, when we bought Polaris, the strategic weapon system, we brought with it a whole new operational philosophy of how we operated our weapon systems, very different historically how the Navy had done its business, the Royal Navy had done its business over the years. But it was kept fairly isolated, from, quite deliberately, from the rest of the Royal Navy. So strategic weapon systems operations require dedicated people, they require very, very specialist training to understand some of the extraordinary disciplines which were inherent to those processes because you were dealing with nuclear weapons. Now, what's been beneficial to the Royal Navy has been spillover from that very, very disciplined approach to how you operate something as serious as the weapon system into other things. But it didn't spill over completely. It was very much, if you look especially in the early days of the Resolution class of Polaris submarines, the strategic weapon system was there isolated in the center of the submarine. The back bit was totally UK, the reactor bit run on UK design reactor and on UK principles, and the front bit was very, very UK. It was essentially an SSN combat system. Yep. Both those were run on what I call UK traditional submarine lines. In the middle was this strategic weapon system which had a different operational culture, but it did, over time, it did spill over because there were some very, very good disciplines in terms of process, procedural adherence, management of the system, logistics management, all these notice when you think about it, which you couldn't help but admire, and indeed learn from and inspire from. So there were sort of longer term benefits, but there were still very much two sort of distinct ways of operating submarines. You know, there was the UK way and there was the SWS.
Fantastic, thank you very much. Can I continue on that theme a little bit more, and especially in your later work?
Yeah.
When we talk about British deterrence and a British policy, nuclear weapons policy, do you think that is distinct in a different way from operational, but do you think that's distinct from an American policy, and if so, how?
Right, well, first of all, it's different in terms of scale.
Yes.
You know, the Americans have a triad of capabilities, and they remain the major superpower in the globe, and are equated in terms of nuclear firepower in the now Russians, the Soviet Union. It's interesting that it's not diminishing very much. So they operate in terms of scale at a totally different level to us. But there are some differences in policy, recognised differences in policy, in sort of declaratory policy, disarmament. We are signatories to the comprehensive test ban treaty, and the US is not. So there are some differences in approach to how global. I don't think there are any differences that global disarmament, nuclear disarmament, remains a long-term objective. But how you get there, the map of how you get there, how best to get there, it is perhaps a little different. We see benefits in the comprehensive test ban. The US obey the treaty, but I think thinking is there that it's a flawed treaty. And they have different views on how to curb proliferation, all the rest of it. And also in the use of nuclear weapons, if you look at the minutiae of the words of how and when these weapons might or might not be used, again, there are subtle differences there. Although there are fundamental agreements of, you know, that nuclear weapons form the ultimate guarantee of nation security, and should that be threatened, and how they might be used, very good agreement there. So it's a mixture. In some areas we are clutched in almost at one, but in others there are recognised differences, which in the policy area you just learn to manage, because those differences are subtle and they're not hugely significant politically, but to those of this sort of condescending who deal in sort of nuclear weapon issues, they are there.
Fantastic. Now, I know that you served on HMS Resolution. I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about that, like on a day-to-day basis, how it was.
What it was like?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in the days when I was serving, it was still so the policy of the day was then that we had one submarine in the UK on patrol at all times at what was called quick reaction alert. And that was to be able to react to the bolt out of the blue threat. And we were at very, very short notice to fire should we be called upon to do so. And that imposed a sort of number of disciplines in that the four submarines had in a very, very sort of tight cycle, because one was always refitting at any one time, another one was sort of working on the trials. So essentially we probably had two submarines in this patrol cycle, one of which had to be on quick reaction alert at all times. Now, that may not sound it, but actually that is quite tricky to manage in terms of maintenance of the hull, crew training, crew welfare. We were fortunate in the Polaris program to have two crews, which is something we picked up from the Americans. So there was one crew on the submarine sort of operating and doing its business, whilst the other was sort of taking leave and doing some training and doing sort of some of the domestic things as well. So if one's honest, I don't think the routine was nearly as harsh as our brothers who were in the SSN flotilla, you know, the hunter killers. Yes. We only have a single crew However, the nature of the business was such that when you did deploy a patrol, you didn't communicate with anybody, and you did stay at sea for really quite a long time, you know, 9, 10, 12 weeks was a sort of normal patrol length, other than the terminal touch with anybody at all, although of course you could receive traffic, but you couldn't send it. So it was quite a sort of strange existence. Also, to a lot of submariners, it was even more strange in the operational circumstances. When you heard something, one of the things you didn't to do was to be detected by anyone. So the natural thing for a submariner, of course, is when you hear something in the ocean, you go, my goodness, what is that? Then you go and investigate, and what could it be? Whereas in the Polaris program, of course, you have to completely obviously get it right away. And at all times, sort of as maintaining this quick reaction alert status. So you ran a sort of daily routine. You sort of got up in the morning, you had breakfast, and you had lunch, and you had tea, and you had supper, and you went to bed at night. You turned the lights on when it was daytime, you turned them off when it was nighttime. You had to conduct sort of a daily routine to keep yourself safe. And you had to do things to occupy your mind during, you know, like a lot of sort of operational military things. There's a lot of time where not a lot is going on, and a few times where there's an awful lot going on, and I can see where you're coming. So you have to sort of discover things within yourself that occupy your time and sort of these past times. And also test your character as well with human nature, that you're stuck with individuals for a very, very long time. So it's fairly weird old existence.
A unique existence then. How heavy did it weigh on your shoulders, do you think, the role that you were there to provide?
Right, yes, and that's a very important question you asked. My personal answer to that was that I sorted the whole issue of would I, wouldn't I pull the trigger, or whatever sort of metaphor you want to take it, because indeed, yes, I was the weapons officer of HMS Resolution, so my finger was on the sort of symbolic red trigger, and low as part of a sort of a great cycle. So you have to sort out in your own mind, before you really take on the job, that this is acceptable to your conscience. And I went through some fairly rigorous intellectual thinking and understanding of nuclear weapons issues before I settled that in my own mind. But once I had, then provided all the checks and balances, which I knew were all met, I was pretty convinced of what I would do. And I think that was true of my people as well. And I mean, the thing that's very good about the sort of safety and security aspects of the strategic weapons system is that it is very much a people-based system. Mm. You know, you need two people to do nearly every action in the firing chain, which is very complex. You know, it's not just one man thinking, gosh, it's time to fire, push the button, and you'll be all relieved to hear. It is a very complex process, and one that, again, I went through in my own mind, is safe, secure, and there to be used only in extremis, as dictated.
That's interesting. Is there any exception whereby it wouldn't have been from the Prime Minister, or any situations whereby a launch could have been encouraged or requested?
I mean, well, one's entering into difficult areas now of, you know, some sort of hypothetical situations and what ifs, and obviously one goes through that in one's own mind. Mm. I think it would be difficult for me to articulate in a record interview too much. But suffice to say that I was content that the firing chain procedures were robust, that in no way could any submarine commanding officer or anybody who was not properly authorised to do so commit ourselves to an unauthorised launch. And I was satisfied that the procedures were in place to ensure that was safe. And that these are, you know, it's very important that everybody understands when they join a boat that these are not military weapons. Mm. These are not weapons that you give to some general or admiral to sort of say, go and achieve a military objective with these weapons. These are political weapons to be used under the authority of the government of the day and his personal authority of the Prime Minister. So they are not at the will of any military commander. Now, that is quite a difficult thing to sort of get through to people, you know, who spend most of their time in the military, looking at military tasks, working for military people, and achieving military objectives. You know, part of the training is to understand.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about when you worked for the procurement executive? So how Polaris developed and changed. I'm thinking of Chevelin, I'm thinking of eventually into Trident, I'm thinking of things like that. What do you think were some of the major influences on the development and change of Polaris?
Right. Well, the Polaris weapon system was an extraordinary piece of engineering. It was hatched in a very, very short time scale. I mean, I've forgotten. Have this thing to see, and of course in those days, in the sort of 50s and 60s, we're talking about that, the whole idea of launching a nuclear-tipped missile under the water was almost bizarre. The fact they did it in such a short time was quite extraordinary, and the engineering and the disciplines that went with that were really extraordinary is the word, and the innovation they used and the utility of really off-the-shelf engineering. I mean, you know, things like the trolley system, as we call it, which looked at the sort of lift system on its side. You know. Things in navigation, the ship's inertial navigation system was pinched from civilian aircraft. You know, it was that marvelous bit of innovation. So we took on board a very well-engineered system, and together with it some extraordinary sort of safety, security and procedural discipline. So there wasn't, in the early days, there wasn't much to do. As far as the strategic weapon system went, there was an awful lot to do was engaging that system into the UK submarine engineering wise. You know, from the difference that showed the power supplies were good enough. Interfaces with the rest of the ships and systems operated directly with things like the hopper system. You know, so there were some major engineering challenges there, and also to get this sort of new culture and training in the UK. But we accepted a system which was really pretty good. I think one of the lessons we learned from the early days of Polaris was not to fiddle with it, because you fiddle with it at your cost.
Yeah.
And even a simple thing that, you know, the United States boats will have 20, 24 tubes, 16, you know, that was costing.
Really?
And any time that we need to go UK unique, cost us a lot of money. Even sometimes the most simplest of things, you know, the generator change, saw over the years and the cost of that change. So the lesson we learned fairly early on was don't fiddle with it. But of course, we did have a problem with Polaris in, again, this was one of scale, about its ability to defeat the hardscope ABM system, which was pretty fundamental to the criteria, which of course generated the Chevelin solution, which was again, and this is blowing our own trumpet, our UK's trumpet now, was again a remarkable piece of physics, science and engineering, because some of this you have to take with a bit of a pinch of salt, it's second hand, but I was a young officer and Chevelin was coming through, and the understanding was that the American scientists said this was too difficult and that we'd never be able to do it. And the fact that AWD did eventually some significant cost, was a remarkable piece of science and engineering, and really boosted the UK's reputation amongst the sort of the nuclear consortium of the fact that we proved we could do it and did it, because it's a remarkable piece of kit. But of course it cost a lot of money, and there was a political price as well. So a lot of lessons learned from that. And then into Trident, as the, you know, I think those are two lessons that we learned from the class program, is don't fiddle with the system. And, you know, going it alone is really unwise unless you really have got very strong arguments to do so. So when Trident came along, it was very much to furrow the American mind, and this was absolutely fundamental reasons why you shouldn't. There were a few of those, small, you know, one being, as I say, 16 June versus 24.
Yep.
And there are a few things like that. But I think those are the sort of the higher level loans like that. The lower level, of course, the benefit for us was being open to this marvellous innovative engineering and this, I keep on using the term, this extraordinary discipline that these system engineering disciplines that go with them for safety, security, procedural adherence and maintenance. Really something to be saluted.
Fantastic. Now we are approaching the end, so I've got a few questions left. I'd like to ask you one more broad one and then we'll kind of take it back to the MDA.
Sure.
I'm really, really interested in how your understanding of deterrence has changed, and if you think that deterrence as it stands in Britain has evolved over the last 30, 40 years, or whether it remains consistent and it's a requirement today in the same way that it was before.
I think it's changed enormously. I mean, it was relatively simple. A very well-defined threat from the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. There was a very clear scenario in terms of potential Warsaw Pact invasion of Western Europe and how Western Europe would react to that. The objective of nuclear weapon systems and the deterrence criteria were pretty clear, pretty straightforward. And the policy evolution from mutually assured destruction, flexible response, all those sort of things, came through this one single threat at all times. So it was relative in terms, the policy of nuclear deterrence was pretty straightforward. Since the end of the Cold War, it's become much, much more difficult and much more complicated. In the terms of the sort of Armageddon nuclear threat is dormant, I think is the term I would have to say, because there are countries, Russia and China, who still possess a major nuclear arsenal, and it is quite clear that they are updating that nuclear arsenal, and they have been adversaries in the past. I'm not saying that they're going to be in the future, but one has to watch how global relations are going to evolve. But really what has changed the whole nature of deterrence has been proliferation.
Yeah.
And proliferation of nuclear capability, in that a large number of countries now, and an increasing number of countries, unfortunately, are yearning to have a nuclear capability, because nuclear weapons still have this sort of almost mythical attachment to them, that they are symbolic of power, certainly. They are the only true weapons of mass destruction. I don't find them very open, because nuclear weapons are very different. So and they are the only ones that have a proven huge destructive power and a degree of certainty that goes on with that capability. So with proliferation rife, nuclear deterrence has become much more difficult, because how do you deter a smaller smaller than yourself, and perhaps isn't going to engage nuclear weapons on your may engage in nuclear weapons on your troops deployed abroad and your interest deployed abroad. And I think deterrence as a subject went out of vogue in the post-Cold War. It's all gone. But I'm pleased is the wrong word, but I think it's high time that it was recognised that deterrence, and deterrence that's in its widest sense,
yes.
Because nuclear deterrence is only one sort of important right-hand end pillar, but deterrence works across a complete spectrum of diplomatic, political, and military activity, and how do we operate a policy of deterrence to prevent, so after all, the whole objective of deterrence and nuclear deterrence, as well as to prevent war, how do we re-engage and understand how deterrence may be implemented in today's security?